Let's see, January, I'll get the month right, 17th, 2005.
I still don't make it.
January 19th, 2005. Today we're going to be talking about mental health, and it's one, the first of probably several sessions, and right now, we would like to have a report on the Governor's Mental Health Task Force and the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. And on the agenda, Barry Cast, who's with the Department of Human Services. He is unable to be here, but Bob Nickel, who is Director of the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, is here to start our informational meeting. Bob?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, again, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is part of Health Services and the Department of Human Services. It's a welcome opportunity to be here so early in the session and provide you with an overview of the public mental health system and focusing particularly, as you mentioned, on the Governor's Mental Health Task Force and the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. And I think if there's time, we could talk a little bit about some ideas that we have for improving services, some examples of things that we're already doing that may indicate things for the future, as well as hopefully some time for questions and discussion if the committee would like that. So I will proceed. I'm not sure if the chair would want Gina Furman to join me because there may be things that would come up in my presentation that she could help answer. So
I would love to have Gina Furman come up and introduce herself, and then you can just cross over. Just for informational purposes, Senator George is sick, and Senator Cruz is sick, and that is why they are not here. Yeah, something's going around.
Nothing to do with mental health, though. I don't think.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson. For the record, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs.
I've provided an outline for the members of the committee, and I will try to follow that as much as possible, and certainly am open to answering any questions as I go through the presentation. As an introduction to the Governor's Mental Health Task Force, I thought it might be useful to do a very quick 50,000-foot view of some of the key things that have happened in Oregon mental health history. So with your indulgence, I would like to start with that and talk about the very earliest Oregon arrangements for mental health, and that started at the organization of the territorial government. In 1843, the provisional government formed a Champaign adopted laws and appropriated $500 to defray the expenses of caring for, I think at the time, about five people that were identified as mentally ill, and the families simply were not able to handle them without some assistance. At that time, the territorial government began to set in place some of the early arrangements for how to care for people who really didn't have any assistance available and who probably didn't want any assistance, so probably the early beginnings of the civil commitment system. At that time, probate courts were directed to determine the disposition of persons for whom there were questions about how to handle them. A jury of 12 intelligent and impartial men, that's a quote, a jury of 12 intelligent and impartial men were to investigate whether a person was insane, and that's also a quote. Those were the terms that were used in those days. There were probably quite a few women in the state of Oregon right now who are glad that we don't rely solely on a jury of 12 intelligent and impartial men, because that could be viewed as less than partial. But at any rate, if the jury decided that there was reason to believe that the person was insane, a trio of guardians were appointed. Can you imagine? We have about 1,000 mentally ill persons a year who are civilly committed, and that would take 3,000 people looking after just those people who are civilly committed if we had a trio of guardians at this point. At the organization of the territorial government, the county was made responsible for paying for the cost of care. And I would submit that was really the beginning of the county and state tensions over mental health. And they've been here from the very beginning, and they've continued on. In 1855, for example, the counties made an appeal for territorial funds, and the territorial legislature at that time granted those funds. But the following year, the territorial government funds were revoked. So again, the push and the pull between the state and the county goes back even prior to statehood. But I think the important point here is that the beginning of the counties is the backbone of the community mental health or the public mental health system really go back to territorial days. This is not a new kind of thing. Another trend that's apparent from the very beginning is that in 1862, the state, what we later became known as the state hospital, at that time there was a physician, Dr. John Hawthorne, who opened the first, what he called an asylum, and used state funds to care for people. And in 1862, that institution opened with 12 people. In 1863, 1 year later, the number of patients that he was caring for had jumped to 28, so more than a doubling of the population. In 1866, 4 years after opening, that number was 77. In 1870, it was 111. In 1874, it was 194. One of the lessons from this is, as we struggle with very real and serious problems in our census in the state hospital, is that, again, the expansion of state hospital services is nothing new. It goes back to the very beginning, too, of the time when we had those kinds of institutions. Another interesting fact that I came across is that in 1877, mental health's share of the Oregon state budget was 52%. So, again, one of the points to be made here, I think, is that although we have considerably less than 52% of the budget now, these are issues that have been with the state since the beginning of the state's organization, and this is not a sidelight in my perspective of something that the state is in the business of doing. It really is at the core of things that state governments, and not just in Oregon, have always done. I provided a couple of handouts, and one thing that I might want to call your attention to is that...
Senator Morse?
Bob, do you have a copy of what you just read? You didn't make copies, but that's great information.
Madam Chair, Senator Morse said, yes, I do. It's part of a slide set that I have used on previous presentations, and I'd be happy to make the slide set available.
Yeah. Either way, just the written form, because I think it's helpful to have the background of some of these issues. I think that's very informative.
Thank you.
Senator Courtney?
Okay. One of the handouts that you do have copies of looks like this, and it's a graph. It really tells a huge story of what's happened since the 1950s until at the time this graph was put together in 1995. This is not the state hospital population. This is the rate of hospitalizations for psychiatric purposes in the state. And as you can see, we did peak in the late 50s, at which time we reached also the peak of the state hospital population, which was about 5,000, by the way, in the two or three different sites that we had. But you can see that starting in the early 60s, there was a dramatic decline in the usage of hospitals for the care of people with mental illnesses. And I think, as you probably know, too, up until...
Senator Courtney?
Thank you, Chair. There is, I hope, clarification. We're talking civil and forensic, or just civil here? I mean, these things get... this is a clarity that needs to be set out there for us, because those are two, as you know, very distinct categories. So what did you mean in terms of the 5,000 or whatever this is?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, these are all psychiatric hospitalizations, so it would include what we now think of as forensic as well as civil commitments.
All right, so it's a combination of both.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to clarify. Thank you.
So as you can see, we went from a high of 293 per 100,000 population in about 1959 or 60 down to, at the time this data was put together, 27 per 100,000 in 94-95. Obviously, something major has happened during this period of time, and I would submit that the thing that's happened is that the community mental health systems have expanded considerably in order to handle people who would otherwise have been in state institutions at frankly, a considerable cost to the state. I also would just share the bias that I think the degree to which people can be served in their communities, as long as they're not a threat to public safety or themselves, I think that's a humane and long-standing policy decision that the state has followed. Another piece of information that I wanted to share with you is another graph here, and let me turn back in my pages to this. The mental health and Oregon Health Plan dollars combined is in a pie chart that looks like this. And without going through all of the details of this particular handout, what it shows is that about 25% of the total funds for mental health in Oregon, that includes Oregon Health Plan dollars as well as mental health dollars, state general fund dollars, about 25% is in the state hospital, and that's largely state general fund, and about 75% of the state budget is spent in the community mental health system, which Gina and her colleagues represent. So Oregon is, last I checked, the most recent data is about in the top 10 states for the percentage of the total state budget that's spent in the community rather than in an institutional setting. So that could be either good or bad depending on how you look at these things, but I just think it's important to understand the overall contours that Oregon is a state that has chosen to invest fairly heavily in community mental health programs.
Mr. Nickel, what about, do you have numbers that are associated with this? How many mental health patients are in the community mental health? How many have been served and how many have been are in the state hospital?
Madam Chair, these are rough numbers, but in 2003, 2005, I think we're going to expect to serve somewhere in the neighborhood of about 120,000 people. Of that 120, and that's the total mental health system. Of that total of 120,000, only about 1,500 will have been served in the state hospital.
Thanks.
So you can see again that while the community represents 75% of the budget, they're serving close to 99% of the people. And again, it has to do with the understanding of the much greater efficiencies of serving people in community settings compared to state hospitals. Now, some people really do need to be served in state hospitals, which are obviously the most expensive level of care that we have, at least in the state system. So I would not argue that we, at this point, could do without a state hospital and have everybody in the community. We would have to think through very carefully how we would provide the level of safety and security and treatment intensity in community settings.
One other question, too. Of that 1,500 that are in the state hospital, how many do you feel, roughly, would be just as well served in the community?
Madam Chair, theoretically, once people are stabilized in their mental illness, I think most people could be served in the community. But sometimes that stabilization process takes 2 to 5 years. Those are extreme cases. Some people, for security reasons and because they're under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board, are in the hospital for 10 years or longer. So there's a small group of people for whom I think it may be very difficult to ever find the right kind of community setting. But most people, once they're treated adequately, can be served safely in the community. But again, assuming that the community has the proper facilities and funding and stability to do that.
Thank you.
Can I ask?
Senator Courtney?
Are individuals in the Department of Corrections going to testify today? Do you know? Are they here to testify?
Not today.
Okay. But I need to point out that there is strong evidence that there are several hundreds, maybe as much as 300 or 400 in our Department of Corrections that probably, even though you're using numbers here, that do not include those individuals. If we truly want to deal with issues of mental health here. Is that not correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, that's very correct. And then one of the other handouts that you have in your packet is a document that shows on a broader scope the fact that there are many mentally ill people. And in fact, I think the document says there are still too many mentally ill people who are in our prisons and jails. And I tried to give an estimate based on 2002 data on the numbers of people who are in the criminal justice system.
And I don't know where that goes, Chairman Anderson. 300 or 400 bucket is the state. I'm not into the county jails or 1145 situations, to be honest with you. So I'm sure that the number 300 or 400 is low in terms of overall individuals that we've chosen to put on the corrections side versus the mental health side. But I haven't read your chart, so I don't know whether that's reflected in there as well.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, in fact, the chart that I put together for 2002 data, at that time I was estimating that there were 2,163 people with mental illnesses in either prisons or jails. So it's considerably larger than the number you had earlier.
Thank you.
May I ask?
Senator Morissette.
Thank you.
Okay, a person could be in a prison setting legitimately and have a mental illness, is that right? Are you saying that all but the violence should be in a different setting?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, I think that's a very good policy question to be asking. In my opinion, there are mentally ill people who have committed crimes who were not mentally ill. It was not a cause.
Yeah.
The reason they committed the crime cannot really be attributed to the mental illness itself. And yeah. I think that's a good policy question to ask. What should we, what is the proper disposition for those people?
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about a little bit more history. When community mental health programs were really getting underway, that's really dates from the early 60s, except for a few child guidance clinics that opened really quite a bit earlier than that in the 30s and 40s. The community mental health programs, which were originally largely federally funded, although the hope was that they would be able to take people out of state hospitals and serve them in community settings, in my opinion, reading the history, they really weren't prepared to do that in the 60s. What they were prepared to do, it appears to me, is to provide a lot of psychotherapy and counseling services and even some crisis services. There was some day treatment programming that came out of the early 1960s, community mental health program funding at the federal level. But I think it's a fairly safe conclusion to draw, and not argued much, that largely the early community mental health programs really were not equipped to deal with people who were in state hospitals. And I think part of what we're still dealing with is the legacy of a number of people who left state hospitals in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who never really got into the community mental health system and received the proper kind of care. We've come light years from there in the 80s and 90s. Oregon was one of the first states in the country to start what are called community support projects. Excuse me. And I think today the community mental health programs understand are much better equipped both in terms of personnel and facilities to serve people who would otherwise be in state hospitals. Let me show you one other chart that's in the material I passed out to you. Again, this is material that we worked up a couple of years ago, so there are even more.
Mr. Nichol, we did not get,
that one or the
previous one with you.
Okay, well, I apologize for that, and I'm hoping that we will get those to you. But what the chart basically shows...
Do you want to have staff make copies now?
If that's possible.
Well, why don't you finish your statement?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, the chart shows what we had in 1988 in terms of community beds and state hospital beds prior to the closure of Damish State Hospital. And what it shows for the next year that was on that chart in 2001 is a fairly significant increase in the number of beds that are not outpatient programs, but really residential programs that were equipped to deal with people who would otherwise be in the state hospital. On that chart, I think it shows about 1,088 such placements in 2000-2001. We've created several hundred additional of those kinds of beds in the last several biennia. So the point here is that over the last 10 years in particular, the community programs have really begun to help us create often locked, secure, at least in some cases locked, secure facilities or other highly intensive residential programs that can serve people who might otherwise spend years in the state hospital. So this is something that we talk about each time in Ways and Means, but I just want to make sure that I talked about this phenomenon before this community, because I think what it represents is the increased attention to people with major mental illnesses on the part of the community mental health system. Now, are we where we need to be yet? I think that's a very good question too. But I think that we have worked very hard to create alternatives to state hospital care, particularly over the last 15 years. I would be remiss in not pointing out that we have improved drug treatment. There are many new and, frankly, very expensive medications, but they have helped a great deal with the downsizing of state hospitals really since the 60s, 70s, 80s, and in the 90s. As you know, we've seen some additional medications. I think it's also clear that the federal supplemental security income program, Social Security, have made a great impact on being able to move people from community, from state hospital settings to the communities, because they now can have, if they are considered disabled under the Social Security Act, they can have an assured monthly income, and in Oregon with the Oregon Health Plan, access to health care and medications. And these are incredibly critical resources for us to have if we're going to continue to serve people safely and efficiently in community settings. I mentioned that the beginning of community support projects started in Oregon in the 1980s. Another thing that started happening in the 1980s, particularly in this state but also in others, was an increased awareness of the impact of alcohol and drugs in the lives of people with mental illnesses. One of the things that I worked on a great deal during that period of time was helping to identify the percentage of people living in the community with, say, schizophrenia or bipolar disorder who were having problems with alcohol and drugs. And I think it's fairly well established now that at least 50% of people with these major mental illnesses are struggling to some degree with alcohol and drugs. They may not be classically addicted, but any use of alcohol and drugs for a person with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder can be potentially destabilizing. That's not to say that every time a person with schizophrenia has a drink of alcohol that they're going to be back in the hospital. But generally speaking, this is a combination of disorders that creates additional challenges for people, for their families, and also for the community mental health and state hospital systems.
Senator Marcet.
Yeah, thank you. Well, we have an alcohol recovery fee that we are proposing to recoup some money from the industry and put it into the programs that help fix the problems. And Gene, I believe that a portion of that deals with mental health, right? Yeah, because it is an integral part of dealing with mental illness, is that, you know, alcohol is a part of it, and so those statistics are things that we will be using to make our point. Thank you.
Just along that line, I'd like to point out too that about 60-70% of the acute care psychiatric admissions have alcohol and drug involved, in addition to the mental illness or the psychiatric symptoms that are associated with the admission. So for certain populations of people, that 40-50% figure is probably higher than that. And I would also like to just point out that the criminal justice issues involving people with mental illnesses, about 80-90% of the time there's alcohol and drug in the picture there too. There's a researcher by the name of Linda Teplin who's done a lot of definitive studies in the Chicago area, and her studies show that around 90% of people who end up in the criminal justice system who have mental illnesses are struggling with alcohol and drug problems. So in my way of thinking, the issue of what we now call integrated treatment for people with co-occurring disorders, that's the latest lingo on this, mm-hmm. is really a critical part of getting a handle on the criminal justice issue as well as a lot of other issues. Traditionally, I don't believe we've trained people extremely well. The alcohol and drug treatment field for many years was very separate from the mental health treatment field, and I think again over the last 15 years we've made some progress in knowing what skills mental health and alcohol and drug professionals need to have to serve people that are struggling with both problems. But I think that's a challenge still for workforce development in our state. Other trends in the 80s and 90s that I think we need to keep in mind are that the costs of housing, affordable and safe housing in this state, as in most states, have risen dramatically. And I think another point I want to try to get across is that it's not just a matter of treating a mental illness with medications, as important as that is. People with mental illnesses are struggling with just about every area of their life, whether it's school, employment, housing, social relationships, because of stigma. There are just a lot of issues that impact whether we have a well-functioning public mental health system or not, and I would submit that housing is one of those critical areas. I also wanted to just mention, although I think we've already started talking about this, homelessness and incarceration really were clearly dramatically increasing during the early 80s and 90s and continues to be a significant issue today.
Senator Morissette.
Yeah, thank you. I have a constituent who has an adult foster care home for schizophrenic patients. Is that very common around the state? Are there many of those?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, yes, we have quite a few, several hundred, I could get the exact number, of the adult foster homes.
But dealing with mentally ill people, but, that's what I think.
That's correct.
Yeah. Now, one of the big problems is insurance. And I don't, I'm not up to date entirely on if we have any protections on insurance, if we have a fund of some kind. But I know some of them are closing, and there's a real problem.
Did you want to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, Mr. Nichols said, we do have several adult foster care homes. Insurance is a problem.
Yeah.
Most people are indigent and not covered by the time that they get there. Most of those have been declared disabled by SSI, so they get small SSI payments.
Okay.
That cover.
Yeah, I guess I'm talking about liability insurance for the home operator.
That's a problem.
Okay.
It's quite expensive, and that is done by the home operator themselves.
Okay. There is no umbrella group to pool insurance. I've kind of lost track of this. I know that was discussed at different times. And we need to protect the facilities that are serving the public that we are dealing with right now. And if it comes to... Well, anyway, we need to find ways of keeping those places open.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, yeah, that is an issue that our office is looking at. There, we did identify one program that looked like it might be a possibility because liability insurance is becoming an increasing risk for and increasingly difficult to find. So I appreciate the committee's interest in that issue. I do think it's something that we have not resolved yet.
Okay. And I do believe that there will be a bill going to your committee, Senator Morissette, regarding insurance, liability insurance coverage for adult foster homes.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, also, if you'll remember, last session, then-Senator Minnis proposed a bill. The Association of Oregon Counties, Association of Community Mental Health Programs, worked on it, and it didn't go any place, but we would welcome a bill and would be glad to work with you on that. Yes, Rick.
Thank you, Senator. Bob, and you may have said this, but maybe just clarify, because it always gets a little confusing what we mean when we say community programs, what that really means, a community program. In your opinion, could everybody in the state hospital be served in a community program if it was constructed the right way, of course? And I might be jumping ahead. What does that mean in terms of how we fund? I know there's certain stipulations on who we collect Medicaid dollars on for certain sizes of these programs. So the first question is, could even the most severe forensic types of cases be served in a more localized program?
Madam Chair, Mr. Bacobian, I want to be careful how I answer this. Theoretically, I think we could serve people in community settings. I mean, there's nothing magical about what the state hospitals do. They are working very hard, and they're serving people who are obviously the most challenging people to work with in the state. I do think the costs would rise considerably compared to anything that we currently have in the communities if we were to serve every last patient who's currently in the state hospital. The security issues would be major. The siting issues would be major, and the staffing issues would be major. So I'm not an advocate at this point of closing the state hospital. I do think that there are people that are in the state hospital now who we do have the current technology to serve, and given resources and some additional help with siting issues, we probably could serve them in the community. But where that end point should be, I think, again, is a critical public policy discussion point that I think is well worth having. But my own opinion is that there will be a place for the state hospital for a long, long time. Do we need a different facility? That's also a very good question. I really appreciate the leadership of the Senate President in pushing that issue, and the master plan, which we'll talk about in a little bit, will help us, I think, answer some of those questions. I just want to summarize just a couple of other developments in the 1990s. I think training programs still need to catch up with the research base. I think that the legislature in 2003 was wise to pass Senate Bill 267. It's really focused a lot of attention on what the research base tells us we ought to be doing. It's challenging. It's a simple concept and very complex in some ways to implement, and I'm sure Ms. Furman will want to talk about that at some point. I think There are training issues here. There are workforce development issues here that we probably need to talk further about as policy issues. But as far as do we need to implement everything that science tells us to do, I think we do need to do that. I think that's, in the end, one of the ways that we can assure the taxpayers that we're using their monies wisely. So I'm very supportive of evidence-based practice movement. The property tax limitation that passed in the early 1990s, I just think it's important to have the awareness that that forced a considerable increased reliance on federal funds, particularly Medicaid, for community services. I think we did fairly miraculous things during the 90s and the early years of 2000 to use Medicaid in a wise and effective way, but we have become very, very dependent in the community mental health system on federal Medicaid dollars. As you know, that we can, for 40 cents of state general fund, match that with 60 cents of federal money if the person is Medicaid eligible and if the service we provide is medically appropriate. But I think it's important for the committee to realize how dependent we have become on Medicaid funding in the community. The state hospital uses very, very little federal money, and that's because of federal restrictions on the use of federal money in state institutions. Oregon also has developed many model programs. I'll talk about those maybe a little bit later if there's time. But I think, in particular, the Oregon Health Plan has been a major step forward in terms of reducing the stigma of mental health treatment. It's, you know, mental health diagnoses are included in the prioritized list, just like any other physical health care disorder. We've also created the extended care system that serves people who would otherwise be in the state hospital in a fairly model way, in my opinion, compared to other parts of the country. Challenges for the 21st century, I just wanted to list these, and these are not an all-inclusive list, but there are more mentally ill people in jails and prison, despite a dramatic increase in Oregon to access to acute psychiatric care. We've gone from about 2,000 acute psychiatric hospital admissions 10 years ago to about over 6,000 a year now. So that's, I think, a good trend. In the early 90s, there was a lot of concern about whether people were being denied local acute care psychiatric services or denied access to the state hospital. We've tripled, more than tripled, access. However, despite that, we're still struggling with too many people in jails and prisons. I mentioned evidence-based practices. I think that's going to be an ongoing challenge to continue to implement and train the workforce. I think we need to balance the needs that we have with budget realities. That's a topic that the rest of the legislative session will struggle with, I'm sure. I think we need to continue to work to balance the needs for public safety with those of civil rights. I think the committee should be aware that the Olmstead Supreme Court decision, which basically ruled that it can be a violation of a person's federal ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, rights to keep them in a state hospital or any institutional setting past the time when their treatment team believes them ready to be in the community. That's a completely consistent with the state of Oregon's policies, but it's an additional pressure that I think we all feel and need to be aware of as we plan the mental health system for Oregon. And I think finally we need to be prepared to respond to changing Oregon demographics, the aging of the population, and also the increase in certain cultural minority groups, particularly Hispanic people, create a real challenge for the system to respond to with bilingual, bicultural workers. And we frankly, I think, have some real challenges ahead of us there. I think I could probably go on for quite a while. I do want to show you one chart, and I hope this one did get in your packet. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bracobia and I talked about this earlier. This is the one-page attempt to describe what's in the public mental health system. And although it's complicated, we tried to boil it down to the basic essentials. So let me just walk through it as quickly as I can. There's a small box that says physical health care and medications. In proportion to the money that the state spends on that, that box is way too small. And I just want to point that out. That's essentially the Oregon Health Plan, and it's many, many times larger than the Oregon Health Plan budget for mental health care. These are 2003-05 figures. So Oregon Health Plan plus that population provides a very, in my opinion, effective and modern benefit for outpatient care and what we call acute psychiatric care. In other words, the MHO, the mental health organizations that do the managed care for the Medicaid Oregon Health Plan population, are also responsible for about the first, this is the first 30 days or so of acute psychiatric hospitalization. The reason I think that was a very wise decision to include hospital, that part of the hospital benefit in the Oregon Health Plan managed mental Medicare, Medicaid benefit is that it really does require the county programs to focus on trying to avoid hospitalization by providing a good mix of outpatient services. When someone has to be hospitalized, I think that's great to get them into the hospital, but I think trying to minimize the expense of hospitalizing people, which now runs $800 to $1,000 a day, is an important feature of the system. So the Medicaid managed care organizations are what we call at risk for that part of the acute care hospitalization episode. So that's included in the OHP Plus, OHP Standard, the limited benefit that we have there. That box will probably look smaller depending on what happens at the legislative process with the OHP Standard benefit. And then Open Card is also a Medicaid outpatient benefit and some inpatient benefits. And those are for people who are not under managed care. I'll give you one quick example. We decided that people in the community who are Medicaid eligible and under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board should not be in a managed care environment. We want only a focus on public safety and them getting exactly what they need in the community because of the restrictions on people who have been adjudicated guilty except for insanity. So those are people who are an example of people who are on what we call fee-for-service and outside the managed care environment. And we can talk more in detail about that at some point if you want to, but I just wanted to explain why there's a section called Open Card here. In addition, the community mental health programs offer basically the same set of services that the Oregon Health Plan funds, but we use entirely state general fund for those services. So those are adult outpatient services, children's outpatient services, and crisis services. And again, these are paralleled in the Oregon Health Plan benefit. So it's really not a different set of services, just that we fund these services for people who are not Medicaid eligible, who need the same kinds of services. So for example, if I have, for some reason, I'm not on Social Security disability. I have a schizophrenia disorder. I'm able to work some, so I can't get onto disability. I will not have a Medicaid benefit, but I still may need the same kind of medications and outpatient and case management services and other kinds of services. So that's what that general fund box is for there. Underneath that, I tried to list and kind of descending order the kind of other services that we have available in the community mental health programs. So there are employment supports, crisis respite, acute care hospitals, and then regular residential care, which includes adult foster care, extended care projects, and enhanced care projects. That layer is really for people who are coming out of state hospitals and served in very specialized kind of programs. And finally, we have children's intensive treatment services, which are the psych day treatment programs for kids and the residential psychiatric treatment programs for kids. The numbers there are good numbers for the 03-05 biennium. And finally, state hospitals. In the state hospital, we're just talking about beds. We have actually a few more beds than that now because we opened a forensic unit earlier in the year. And finally, the very bottom layer, I added the federal PATH funds. Those are funds that we get from the federal government, very limited funds, and I think we have them in about five counties now. Multnomah, Marion, Lane, Deschutes County, and I think there may be one other county where we have some limited funds that are used to outreach people who are mentally ill and homeless and try to bring them into the system so that they're no longer homeless. We get them housing. We try to get them the benefits that they need, like Oregon Health Plan, if they're eligible for that. So that's a very rough schematic of what the public mental health system looks like.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you.
A few years ago, we had quite a tussle with the Human Services Department about Scar Jasper Mountain. Are you familiar with that facility?
Yes.
Okay, because they were listed under Services to Children and Families or something like that, and they are a very, very, very intensely managed group of young kids who have been brutalized and can't be... Now, that's one of the six... Now, they're under mental health, I believe. Is that true?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, that is true. They showed us that they indeed were serving a level of kids that really required residential care, and we were able to integrate them into the residential. So that would be in that layer called Children's Intensive Treatment Services.
Okay.
Mr. Nickel? Oh.
No.
On this graph where you're... stating what percentage and the number of dollars to the state hospital, community mental health, admin support, et cetera. When you say there's $192.1 million in the community mental health system, does that include federal monies also then?
Okay, let me find that pie chart.
This isn't just pertaining to general fund dollars. This is pertaining to all funds that go into the mental health system?
Madam Chair, that would be primarily state general fund dollars, but there's probably some fee-for-service money in there. There is probably some of the extended care projects which serve people in fairly high levels of care coming out of the state hospital. So there is some federal money in there, and I have to go back in and look at exactly how much of the $192 million.
So really, community mental health would be getting 60% more... more money. Isn't it a 40-60 match?
Madam Chair, these are total fund numbers, so I would have to go back to see how much of that is actually state general fund versus federal.
Okay, Medicaid. But it includes everything. That's
this does,
yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And I should just point out, though, although we don't say that community mental health is the OHP mental health. In fact, the community mental health programs basically are both of those, the very large gray shaded area, which is 48%, as well as the 25%.
Thank you. Senator Morissette?
Would it be possible to have a list of the children intensive treatment centers around the state? Because I know there's one, I spoke to someone in Pendleton, I believe it was when I was there at one of the county meetings, that was very similar to Scar Jasper Mountain. And have all of those issues been settled in terms of classification now? Because there was some resistance to move Scar Jasper Mountain at the time. In fact, there was a lot of resistance. And I'm wondering if there are other areas that are misclassified.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, as far as I know, I think people feel that they're at the proper levels. I think they're still concerned about whether they're getting paid what they should be paid, just in terms of the state rates that are available. Yeah. But I don't think there are other programs similar to Scar Jasper that are concerned that they are at the wrong level of license.
Good. But I would appreciate it if I could get that.
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, I'll get that for you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Verkobian.
Thank you, Senator. Bob, I understand that the OHP program is just geared at people who are Medicaid eligible, and the community mental health dollars are geared at those who are non-Medicaid, but I would assume most providers and the system kind of depends on a mixture of both clients, and to what degree then does kind of Medicaid dollars help support our system overall? Could our system even exist if we just magically lost Medicaid tomorrow? I mean, is there a real interdependence there between these two for the overall system?
I'm sure, Mr. Bacobian, I'll ask Ms. Furman to respond a little bit more. But in fact, the way we've set things up with the county-based mental health programs is that if you come in and you're Medicaid eligible or you're not, I think that the programs serve you, you know, depending on what your need is, not on what your funding category is. Now, frankly, at the point last biennium when we stripped out almost all of the state general fund for adult outpatient care, that did begin to erode that ability that the county programs had to serve people regardless of their funding source. But I'll let Ms. Furman speak a little bit more to that.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Rick, you're absolutely right. If it wasn't for the Medicaid funds, it would be hard to run a program. And the reason is that we have a lot more clients that are OHP eligible that we serve, and you have to run a mix. Community mental health was not set up to make money. that was set up to take care of the indigent, the people that have the least amount of money, and also the people paid for by state general fund. So Medicaid, OHP, is a crucial part of the system.
Senator Morrison.
Okay, tracking is an important issue. I don't think we can possibly track everybody, but I can remember reading in the Oregonian an article about the county sheriff in Multnomah County saying he was going to handcuff someone to the state hospital fence because every time he'd drive down with someone, he'd drive away. I don't think that's happening as much now. My question is, do we have any way, or is anybody tracking what happens to people as they fall out of the system? I mean, do we know? We should do that. We can't, I don't think, but it would be, if we knew what happened to people as a result of being out of the system, it would help us better understand the importance of dealing with them within the system. Do you have any tracking devices?
Let me take a first shot at Madam Chair. Senator Morissette, I think we're better able now to do some of that tracking. The reason for that is that the department now has an integrated database so that we can see who's accessing different levels of department services. In addition to that, we have some ability to access the state LEDs, the criminal history section. We have some ability now to, I understand, to look at vital statistics. Of course, part of the problem with people who drop out of the system is that they're no longer attached and it's harder to get access to the data that involves them. But I do think we're in a somewhat better position now than we were a couple of years ago to answer those kind of good questions.
I have a question regarding the Medicaid match and how the state hospital doesn't get any Medicaid match, whereas community-based does. And have you looked at contracting with, say, other hospitals to have small units of psychiatric housing so that they could take care of Medicaid match, or maybe that's not possible?
I'm sure that's a very good question, and that, in fact, that's what the Governor's Commission on Inpatient Psychiatric Services report back in the late 80s suggested that we do. So through the 1990s, for that part of what the state hospital used to do in terms of admitting people at acute psychiatric episodes, we've done almost all of that now in the community for the last 10 to 12 years. And then Medicaid money is available in the community-based psychiatric units. For example, Salem Hospital here has a unit, I think, 23 beds, and because it's attached to a large general hospital, they're not considered by the feds to be what's called an institution for mental diseases, and therefore they are eligible for Medicaid. So what we used to do in the state hospital for acute care, which was all state general fund, is now done for the most part in this state in community settings in which Medicaid is available. Other kinds of most of the community projects, in fact, all of the community projects that we've created over the last 15 years to take people out of the state hospital who are long-term care and ready for discharge, there's Medicaid money in that, and almost exclusively. So there's we've made, I think, major dent in that particular issue. The question, I think, really is, are there still people in the state hospital who are ready for discharge who could be served in facilities of 16 beds and fewer?
Right.
And I think that's a piece of the planning that we've had on an ongoing basis.
And are we making progress? I mean, have we already?
Madam Chair, we've created a record number of new community placements this biennium compared to any other biennium for those kinds of settings. It's a good question. Is it enough? And I think, no, it's probably not enough, because we still have people waiting in the state hospital who've been treated, and they followed their treatment plans, and we can't get them out as fast as we can't create new places for them as fast as they're getting ready to come.
Would it be possible to have, or do you have access to the information of how many we have downsized, we have actually placed into the communities, and the new sightings that have happened in the last 2 years?
Madam Chair, yes, and I'd be happy to get that information for the committee.
Can I follow up?
Yes, Senator Morrison.
I sat in on the audit committee last session that met in the evening, and their present were at least two gentlemen, I believe, from Jackson County, maybe, or some, that talked about their facilities. To me, it was a kind of a model small setting for mental health. Gina,
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I think you're talking about a model that's happened in Josephine County.
Josephine County.
Yes.
Would you say just a little bit about that?
Sure. Just to answer the previous question, yeah. I think there's about 278 new community placements, and what Josephine County has done has opened a small home to take new placements. One of the phenomena that's happening is that crisis resolution centers are starting to open. That helps take some of the pressure off the state hospital. And then there's also placements like the one in Josephine County to help keep people at home in their own community rather than to ship them off in the state hospital. And it's as simple as that. When you can fund something below 16 beds in a community that's not attached to a hospital, you can get Medicaid match money.
Who, may I?
Yes.
Do you remember the name of the gentleman that might have represented that facility?
Yes. the gentleman's name is Bob Beckett, and he used to be the Josephine County Mental Health Director, and he now works for a private nonprofit corporation formed by the boards of county commissioners in the Southern Oregon region to do exactly that.
Okay. I think that as long as we're dealing in this committee with mental health, that might at some point it would be good to have him. He came for meetings once a week.
Yes.
And talked about its programs, and I was really impressed with it, and it seemed to me like a model. But there are no forensic cases there, right?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we have begun to move very carefully selected forensic patients into some of the projects that we originally developed for civilly committed patients. We, as yet, do not have a single locked, secure facility that is only for forensic patients.
Okay, good. Well, thank you.
Madam Chair, maybe I should move on and begin to talk a little bit more directly about the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. And I think we've provided the committee members with copies of the report, and we had a couple of extras in case people didn't have them today. It looks like this. And let me just say a little bit about background. During the 03 session, I think there were a lot of concerns about whether the public mental health system was working or not. So there were a variety of reasons for the governor appointing the task force, but I know that Senator Winters was a key person in advocating for that and other legislators as well. The task force consisted of, I think, 21, 22 members. Four of them were legislators, Senators Winters and Carter, and Representatives Tomei and Girard from Klamath County. We're the four legislative representatives. We met over a period of about 9 months. We issued the report. I think one of the key things here, rather than walk through the entire report right now, I wanted to focus on the systemic problems and then just talk a little bit about how we're approaching the action items that came out of the task force. I think one of your handouts, I just did a quick summary of the systemic problems. It's pretty straightforward. It's just taking the bold language that's in that part of the section. And let me just walk through those very quickly. The first one just simply pointed out that the system is significantly underfunded. Now, the task force struggled constantly with this issue. Is it money or is it how we're doing business? And I think the conclusion was it's really some of both. And we need to try to change our models of how we do business, whether we have additional money or not. But there was also, I think, a clear recognition that at some point, if the state is going to have a fully functioning public mental health system, it's probably going to have to look at the finances sooner or later. But the first finding of the task force was that it was believed that the system is significantly underfunded. underfunded. The second finding was that there's a need for greater clarification of the role of the Oregon Health Plan, managed care mental health organizations, and the county mental health, the local mental health authorities. In fact, most of the mental health organizations contract with the county programs that are under the authority of the local mental health authority. But I think this is an area that is somewhat technical, and we've got people working on this issue. I don't know if it's something the committee wants to delve into, but it was recognized that there's still some confusion between how the MHOs deal with things and how the local mental health authorities deal with things. But please bear in mind that in many counties, they are one and the same. It's a matter of how they interface with each other. The third finding was that the state's administration and funding of mental health services is not well coordinated or commonly managed. And the meaning of that is basically that in the budget that my office is responsible for, there's actually more mental health services that are provided outside this budget than are provided for within the budget that I have responsibility for. The Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, local jails, the Department of Education. There are many other sources of mental health funding and activity. Now, often they're contracted back into the county mental health system, which I think is a good thing to do because then there's a chance of it being coordinated at the local level. But the fact is, and Oregon is not unique in this. Most states are in the same situation where there's a lot of mental health activity out there, but only a portion of it is within the authority of the local or of the state mental health authority. So that's an issue, though, that the task force dealt with. The fourth finding of systemic problems was too many persons with mental illness are in prisons and jails, very simply stated. The largest section of recommendations in the task force have to do with that issue. And you can look that up at some point if you want to. I'd be happy to answer questions. I've assigned one staff person to do nothing but try to track how we're going to respond to the 11 or 12 recommendations that have to do with the criminal justice system. Number five, there are far too few community resources, particularly housing for persons with mental illness. I think our estimate is that there are 14,000 additional affordable housing units needed in Oregon. That's a very large number. Now, that said, we have, in my opinion, probably the most capable mental health housing staff person in the whole country. Her name is Vicki Scria. She's been doing this in our office for over a dozen years. And during that period of time, she's helped create, using a lot of different sources of funding, over $75 million worth of housing just for adults with mental illnesses. Now, that's an astounding amount of work that's happened over that period of time. The way we do this is in collaboration with Housing and Community Services, and we have a limited amount of money in our budget. What we do with that is leverage the state general fund that we have with other sources of funding for housing, and for every dollar we have in our budget, in my budget, we're able to find about another $14 or $15 worth of loans that we can create a great deal of housing. So I think Oregon has done a great deal, probably more than most states in this area, but still the question is, are we keeping up? And I think the answer is probably not.
May I?
Senator Morissette.
You're talking group homes.
That is a fire drill.
Stand at ease.
Will committee will stand at ease.
Now out of recess and into session again. We just had a nice little fire drill, and it was good weather, so go ahead, Mr. Nickel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We could probably all have used a little break, so thank you.
Yeah.
I think I was on the fifth of the systemic problems, and talking about all of, in spite of the good work we've done in Oregon around housing for people with mental illnesses, we still don't have enough. There may be a question about whether these are all for group homes or residential programs, and some of the housing resources are, but I think the majority of them are for independent housing, apartments and so on. Those that we have developed. Number six, the failure to plan for and invest in and maintain adequate community resources causes gridlock in the entire public mental health system. Just by way of explanation, I think this one had to do with the concerns, particularly that the local community hospitals have about the crowding that they do experience. And because of the crowding we have in the state hospital, we often have to have patients wait in the community hospitals waiting for a bed to open up for them at the state hospital. And it has to do with really trying to get a better handle on the entire flow of patients through all levels of care of the system. So I think that's what this systemic problem was trying to speak to. Number seven, the emphasis on acute care and incarceration means that the public mental health system does not consistently emphasize early intervention and prevention, especially with children. My own view on this is that we'll never get ahead of the problems until we learn how to catch people earlier. There are examples of really incredibly effective community programs that are doing that, but the problem is that they cost more at the front end, and we struggle to make those kind of investments often.
Mr. Nickel, I am very surprised that it's you actually state here that we spend proportionately less on children's mental health than on adult mental health.
Madam Chair, I believe that that is correct. Part of the explanation for that is the greatest costs in the mental health system are really for hospital level of care, and we simply hospitalize way more adults than we do kids. So that, I think that's probably the best explanation for that.
Thank you.
Number eight, Oregon is among a handful of states that doesn't require significant parity of private insurance. I know that's an issue that's going to be addressed or at least discussed in this session. Number nine.
Just a point. It looks like maybe next week we will be starting our discussions on mental health parity. Senator Morissette.
Okay. I was on the way home last night. I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about the mental health in children, the bipolar, which they used to call it something else, and there's still some confusion about what is mental health in children, right? I mean, the behaviors of children are hard to figure out, and if it's just a misbehaving child or if it's truly bipolar. And I know that in the school system, they usually have special, well, a district may have one class of emotionally disturbed children with a teacher with a ratio of one teacher to six children. But is there still a problem in identifying children's mental health?
Madam Chair, Senator Moore said, I think anytime you have kids who are still working through all of the developmental phases, it can be very difficult. But I think that's also why we need to make sure we have a well-trained workforce so that they can differentiate between normal developmental problems and, you know, more abnormal psychiatric problems. So board-certified child psychiatrists are rare, but I think a very critical part of what we need in the system.
Good. Thank you.
The systemic problem number nine was the mental health system, like most other parts of healthcare, doesn't take adequate advantage of modern information systems. And again, I think the state has always struggled to keep up with the information technology. And computer systems are very critical, and yet we all can think of examples where the development of new databases and computer systems have cost more than we expected. They're, you know, it's an investment that's difficult to make when times are tough, et cetera. So I think we're struggling in that area. And finally, the tenth systemic problem was that there's not a sufficient statewide effort to integrate mental health care and addiction services and traditional medical care and public health initiatives and other social services. So I think none of these are brand new thoughts to anybody. But I think one value that the Governor's Mental Health Task Force brought with it was a very strong consensus among all of the 22 members that these represented the best description of the problems that we do have in the public mental health system. And I hope that these issues are things that we can work with over the legislative session in a more focused way than maybe we were able to do in the previous session. I'm wondering if Ms. Furman would like to just comment on any of this or add any additional.
The only thing I would really like to add is you're correct, Chair Mona Sanderson, that the governor has set a parity task force to start next Monday to start discussing the issue. So I would imagine something will come forward sometime this session on parity. Evidence-based practices, we've been working very closely with the state, the community directors have, and we feel really good about the structure that Mr. Schott has put forward, and we're working on that. What's different this time about the governor's mental health task force report is there seems to be more congruence about things that should happen and the items that have come out of it. And there, as Mr. Nichols said, he appointed a person to track each recommendation, and we on the community side have also teamed up and are working on several of the recommendations to see what we can get done without new money attached. And so we're pleased with that. The other thing that I wanted to point out is you should have this sheet in front of you now. This is basically just for your information. And some of you like to go county by county, so I've provided the county information, but it shows you at least by the main service elements, adults, crisis, and older adults, and then children's and the other are lumped into the other community mental health category, at least the numbers that we serve, so you know. And also in the governor's recommended budget, what the cuts would be under his scenario. And you can see that in adult, patient, and crisis, there's a few cuts, but it's relatively few. It's mostly in the older and disabled adults. So that's just the lay of the land as we are right now. But there's approximately 132,000 people being served in the community mental health system, not Medicaid.
May I ask a question?
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. About a year ago, you received letters from Lane County Children's Mental Health about the disparity between what Lane County was getting. Has that been corrected?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I'm happy to say that we're starting to correct it. We were able to, first of all, reach agreement among most of the mental health directors, and I frankly decided I would take responsibility for making a decision about how to have a plan to get toward equity. Fortunately, through a lot of good discussions over the summer, I think we reached a pretty solid agreement that the plan that I came forward with is something that's acceptable to most mental health directors.
Okay. Now, the real, may I please?
Yes.
The real question, a really tough one. What about equity with Washington, Multnomah, and Clackamas counties? Have you solved that problem?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I don't think that we've solved it, but we did. We were able to reallocate some funds that were in the budget for 2003-05, and we were able to begin making, I think, some definite progress toward helping Washington County, Lane County, particularly in the kids area, Deschutes County in the adult area, and several other counties around the state that actually saw some significant progress for them in getting closer to equity. What I think we still don't have is full, complete equity. I mean, some counties were above the statewide per capita average, and really one of the policy questions is, should we take money away from some counties when we know that no county is really able to meet all of their needs in order to bring other counties up to closer to the average? Fortunately, we were able to find a way to reallocate some existing funds, and so I think we made a good faith effort this time. And
may I follow? Is Washington County happy now? Are they happy?
Madam Chair, Senator Morrison, I probably can't answer for them. I think they do recognize that we made some progress.
So my plan to turn the Tri-County Mental Health over to Metro then is still a viable plan. Very good. I'll drop my bill tomorrow.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, What I would tell you is that all counties have had a good discussion about the path that we're traveling towards equity. And while we're not at full equity yet, all counties have indicated that they're in this for the long haul and are pleased with the progress that is being made towards equity. And yes, Lane County's children's problem is in the process of being solved.
But Clackamas County has not threatened to drop out of your organization.
I have regular conversations with Multnomah and Clackamas and Washington
Good.
County. And at this time, Multnomah County is the only county.
Now, in all seriousness on my part, I believe this is a very difficult problem. There's some historic reasons why there was that equity difference, and I recognize those. And once those gaps occur, it's very difficult to go back and try to undo something. And so I really... I'm glad that you are making some progress in the discussion. Good. Thank you.
You said Multnomah County's not participating.
Correct.
They got all the money. May I just follow up with another very it is a serious question. Multnomah County, because they are the center of the state in a sense, probably attract people to that area for a variety of reasons, you know, and so people tend to gravitate toward the big cities. And so do they have a handle on outside people coming from the outside that they are required to serve? I imagine that's part of the problem, isn't it?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, we actually addressed this question last session in a number of forums, and what we found was that the urban drift into Multnomah County wasn't actually as significant as people thought.
Okay,
there was inflow and outflow to all counties.
Okay, good.
I would suggest that at some point in time that you perhaps invite Multnomah County personnel to come and talk about that issue and others, as I cannot represent them.
I just had sent a note to Mr. Berkovian to invite them to speak to us.
Madam Chair, if I could respond also to that question from Senator Morissette. One of the things that we agreed on is that we would use a Center for Mental Health Services formula that's weighted, that takes into consideration some of the factors that Multnomah County has brought forward before. So that was part of the agreement on the plan to get to equity, is to use what we call the CMHS Kessler formula. And I'm not enough of a technician to describe all the details to you, but it does take into account things like urban issues and poverty and some of the factors that we think may lead some people to move toward a metropolitan area.
Good. Thank you.
All right. Well, with the Chair's permission, maybe I'll shift now and talk about the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan.
Senator Cornyn.
I was watching the shifts here. Thank you, Chair. The issue on number 8, Oregon is among a handful of states that does not require significant parity or private insurance coverage for mental health conditions. Now, Senate Bill 1 is coming in. Senate Bill 1, number 1 Senate bill, will be on mental health parity, and I expect it'll meet the same fate as it's always been. I do not expect it to get through this session. So let's get that out of here, right here and now. But what I want to know is, since the other litany of points you list deal with, and although you've beautifully pointed out it's a matter of not having enough money, but also our approaches. This is an evolving science. We're struggling still, which I think you're going to get into the master plans, of how to best do these things. How can we best deliver these services? If there was mental health parity in Oregon, and this is not a public hearing on mental health parity, I assume the bill will be coming here, so we'll at least have a public hearing on it, which will be a lot of fun. How much would that play into the funding issue, in your opinion? Since underfunding and funding appears numerous throughout these 10 points, so it is at least somewhat of a fact.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, without a detailed analysis of what parity would mean for the public system, excuse me, I don't believe it will have a major impact on the funding issue. I think it would help, because part of what happens is when people don't have insurance that covers their basic mental health needs, if they're in crisis, they will come to the public system. So I think it would help alleviate some of the stress on the public mental health system, but is it going to be a major windfall for the public mental health system? I don't think it will be.
Okay. One other thing, and the chair pointed out something very interesting about how much attention we pay to the children versus the adults. Now, you know, you're being very much of a gentleman. There are theories that we do, we talk about the children, all the talk we do about children, but we spend all the money on adults. A number of doctors have told me that very straightforwardly, that that is interesting about our society. If you listen to what we do, we spend a great deal of time on children, but all the money is spent on adults. And you didn't say that. You came up with a polite answer that it was a number, it was a matter of numbers and things. Do we have an attitude? We do have attitudinal problems in the area of mental health. For example, compared to corrections. That's just my opinion. There is an attitudinal problem. It's a sports analogy. You know, you've got an attitude that we need to deal with. Is there an attitude regarding, in the area of mental health, regarding adults versus children?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, you know, we had a chance to look at some of our Medicaid data on this in the last 6 months or so, and we were able to break it down county by county, and we had a methodology that allowed us to estimate whether some adult money was being spent for kids service or and vice versa, some kids money was being crossing the line serving adults. We have found a couple of counties where we think that that's probably true, that there's a drain in some sense of money that came through capitation under the Oregon Health Plan that really should be for kids. Our office, through the budget note process for the Children's System Change Initiative, established a principle that children's money needs to be spent for children and adult money needs to be spent for adults. And we're in the process of working on a couple of counties where it seems like that there has not been careful enough attention to what happens to the children's capitation money. So I'm trying to give you a little bit more of a definitive answer here in terms of something other than what I said before. I think there are some counties where this has been an issue, and we are going to be pursuing that.
Madam Chair, one more, which will get me in more trouble. So, therefore, you're calling for an audit of the mental health county programs?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I don't know if I would call it an audit, but we have reviewed the data, and we're going to go, and we've already begun that discussion with counties.
I'm not being fair to you, and I do like you, and you know that, but you are my star witness, you are my tank, and I'm a private, and I'm hoping that you will say the things I want you to say, but you're too delicate, so you won't call for an audit. But you have publicly admitted here on a record that some funds are being commingled that shouldn't be, children and adults, and that you're going to ask some questions and look into some of the things, right? Is that not correct? Even though the Secretary of State does audits and you don't, so the audit won't be done, but at least you found funds aren't going the way they should be going in some counties. And let's not put all counties in this, and let's not make this bigger than it is, but we are having a discussion here, you and I.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, under the risk arrangements with the MHOs, there's not a requirement at this point in the contracts that the capitation payments that they get for kids can only be spent on kids. But that's the policy decision that we're moving to, and we're now working on the contracts so that in the future we will have some ability to go in and audit these programs.
Thank you, Mr. Decker. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me in that litany of questions.
It's extremely important, and the mantra sort of throughout the whole building, more accountability, no more taxes, but definitely accountability, and that includes auditing and proper use and efficiency of our funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, what I would tell you is that what we've been successful in doing, especially over the last two bienniums, is having the state and the county work together on accountability. So it's not that anybody's they're not doing anything illegal, but the policies that we have put forward, we're trying to manage within so we don't have to be punitive, if you will. So we're doing a good job of making sure that the policies set are followed by the counties.
Chair, I'm not suggesting illegality here, but I am suggesting views of interpretations of policies may be differing than what was intended when certain policies were enacted. That's what I'm saying. I'm picking my words carefully since it's very early in the session, and I'll make enough enemies as I go along. I want to start slow.
And And that's why we have the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. So these items that come to us, we can work together as a group to straighten out so they don't come to you.
Okay. We have about 20 more minutes.
Madam Chair, I'd like to spend a few minutes now talking about the state hospital situation, yes, particularly focusing on the OSH master plan. First of all, just for the record, today we are 59 forensic patients over our funded capacity in the Oregon State Hospital. We have not exceeded the licensed capacity. I want to emphasize that we're not in difficulty in terms of the licensed limit, but we are at a point where we're continuing to struggle with the issue of more inflow compared to the outflow that we can get out, despite, you know, again, record-setting attempts and record-setting products out in the community to move people to. The Psychiatric Security Review Board just set a record of 126 adjudications for 2004. The previous high was 110, which was in 2003, and prior to that, it had been around between 60 and about 78, something like that. I have the exact numbers if you'd like to have those, or you can get them from the board. The point is that there are more and more people being adjudicated to the Psychiatric Security Review Board now than ever before. And if these were admissions that only lasted 10 days, that wouldn't be as big a concern. But many of the people do need to be in the hospital for a year or two before the board is able to feel comfortable sending them to the community, given their charge with public safety. So what we're having is, you know, a ballooning of people, many of whom are going to be there for some period of time. And in spite of putting out, you know, record numbers of resources and creating community placements that can serve these people, we're not keeping up with the number of people coming in the front door. I would also like to say that I don't think this is a bad thing necessarily, that the PSRB is seeing a record set of adjudications. It may very well be that people are recognizing that people who have mental illnesses should not be going through the correctional system and should be going through the mental health treatment system. That's why the PSRB was set up. So I'm not thinking that this is necessarily a bad thing, but in terms of the current population at the state hospital, we are definitely struggling. So,
yes, Senator Courtney, then Senator Morissette.
Just to show the magnitude, would you please confirm my statement that I'm about to make to the Chair, Monis Anderson, and Senator Morissette, that the 2003-05 budget was based on 1.67 admits per month, and it is now 6.23. See, I'm not bad for a month. Those are figures that were delivered to the E-Board 2 weeks ago because of the crisis we're in. I just wanted that. Is that correct or not, Mr. Nicholas?
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, the only part that's just slightly off is that it was 1.5 net increase, but you were very close to the mark, and the 6.2 is right on.
All right.
Also, between December and January, when we between testimony to the e-board, we had a net increase of 12 forensic patients. So although the average had been 6.2, for 1 month, it was 12.
Did you, yes, Senator Morissette, and then I have a comment.
Well, thank you. You know, you're supposed to leave your cell phones and anachronisms at the door. You know that?
Yes.
There's a big major fine in this committee if you use PSRB.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, I should have stated Psychiatric Security Review Board. That's what PSRB stands for. Thank you for the
That's
reminder.
A dollar fine that you owe the chair here.
And
for,
earlier,
for a good cause.
Yes.
Is it? It is a good cause, isn't it?
Definitely.
Oh, okay.
It goes all to mental health for children.
Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Thank you.
You had said earlier that a lot of the incarcerations or the forensic cases are attributed to drug and alcohol abuse. Is this increase primarily due with the psychiatric, with the adjudications, a lot of that a result of alcohol and drug involvement?
Madam Chair, it's our speculation, our educated guess, if you will, that is one of the major driving forces.
Okay.
The methamphetamine problem is an epidemic in the state. I think we're all very aware of that, and I think that's part of what's driving this.
Okay.
But there may be other kinds of things as well. For example, it may be that there are certain kinds of views or approaches that are happening within the public defenders group, within the district attorneys, within the courts. Dr. Fickle and I are now arranging meetings with each of those parties to better understand if there's some change in thinking or practice so that we understand better what's driving this. And finally, I've asked the evaluation team within my office to put together an approach that would give us a more systematic picture of what's happening here. And I hope in the next, 6 months we can have a more systematic answer for that, for that question.
Okay.
One more.
Okay.
What is the Psychiatric Secure Review Board? I'm not aware of that. Now, they look at people who are adjudication to get the proper placement.
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, the Psychiatric Security Review Board was enacted into statute, I think, in 1977 by the Oregon Legislature, and it was really an attempt to send people who had mental illnesses and who the term now is guilty except for insanity, rather than to send them into the correctional system, to send them into the treatment system.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I really want to cover part of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. Are you ready to transition?
Madam Chair, I'm ready to do that. My office and the Department of Human Services released a request for proposals on, I believe, January 3rd of this year, and soliciting an architectural engineering planning firm to come in and help us with phase one of an Oregon State Hospital plan. The proposals are due January 24th. We'll be reviewing them on January 31st. I hope that we can provide an indication to the winning proposal early in February, hopefully the next day. I don't even know if that's a working day, February 1st, but if it is, we'll probably try to shoot for that. And then we'll try to negotiate a contract within 2 weeks so that the work on the phase one of the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan could start as early as February 15th. These are all the most optimistic assumptions that I'm making for you, although I can tell you I did submit the list of reviewers today before I came here for the January 31st review process. So I think we're moving along the right track. The scope of work, I think, is probably of some interest to the committee, and I believe you may have copies of the request for proposals. If you look in that proposal, page 5, 2.1 talks about the scope of services. Phase one will be what we call a framework plan, which means basically we're going to have a set of general recommendations that come out of the phase one. It will involve, as I mentioned before, a team of professionals to analyze and make recommendations at a high level. We have specified that representative employees will participate in this. There were concerns, I think, from the union that this not be a process that would not bypass them, and I've assured them, in fact, that we will include them through this process. And it's written into the RFP itself, the request for proposals, excuse me. The tasks are listed there. I think all of them are important, but I'd particularly call attention to number two, review existing studies and plans. We have a plethora of studies that have been done. The need now is to really focus these and begin to make some decisions. We need to look at the hospital property and look at things like adaptive reuse, potential demolition, surplus of lands and buildings. Excuse me. The team will provide a general historic property assessment. It will provide a summary conclusion and recommendations on the future of the hospital, including services the hospital should provide and its role in the Oregon mental health system. And I think, to me, this is probably the key here. As we've talked several times in other settings, it's not going to be enough to just design a new hospital architecturally. We have to think about what the role is going to be, what the role of the community is. Are there going to need to be some other satellite, for lack of a better term, satellite facilities, so that we don't have to build an exorbitantly expensive and large institution? What would we need to have surrounding the basic state hospital facility? That's why number six says that the team would be asked to describe the characteristics of optimal siting for psychiatric system facilities, plural, identified in five above. It could be that we would just design one project in our facility, but it might be that we should think about a more complex approach to it. We will ask to have a general discussion about whether we would need to have a joint facility with the Department of Corrections. On that point, I'd just like to tell the committee that we've had four, and I think it may be five meetings already with the Department of Corrections to begin talking about what a shared facility might look like, how big it might need to be, what functions it would perform, where it might be, how we would work out a shared program, and what some of the barriers to that might be, what some of the advantages might be. So we've begun that discussion already. We would also ask the contractor to look at an inventory of state lands that might be appropriate for siting. We would have a general discussion about how the recommendations might be phased. And finally, we would need to look at how we would proceed to phase two if the legislature were to approve the governor's recommended budget, which has, I think, $350,000 for the phase two master plan. And finally, the last task on this list would be to have a general discussion about costs or savings that could be realized using several different scenarios. So that's a quick walkthrough of what the request for proposal and what the statement of work would be doing, and I would be happy to answer any questions about it.
With Measure 11's requirements and the building of new prisons, would some of the funds that are required to build prisons, could they be used to build facilities that would have a collaborative jail psychiatric component to it?
Madam Chair, that's probably a question that I would best defer to the Department of Corrections. My assumption is that if it were a shared facility, there would be, you know, open grounds for that kind of a discussion. But I think that the Department of Corrections probably would be in a better position to answer that than me.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Courtney.
Yeah, I just had the opportunity to view this document a few weeks ago, and Mr. Fickle came to my office. There is an important point here, my fellow senators, on page 4. It's been somewhat passed over, and I think there's a perception out there that isn't quite accurate. There have been a number of studies and task forces that in the last 20 years, that point to mental health system improvements needed. The role of a hospital is acknowledged, but there has not been a specific master planning effort focused on the functioning of the mental health system in the hospital's specific place, size, location, structure within the system. So this master plan is not simply going to be a repeat of what's already out there. We have not, it's my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, ever done this, what we're trying to do. And I do want you to understand the magnitude of the task is daunting, because March 1, basically, if all goes right, these certified smart people jump on this thing. They're supposed to have a draft by May 2nd and a final thing by May 15th. And the reason that's being done is because we're assuming we'll still be here. And to the extent that we can be players in view of that master plan, it will give us an opportunity, perhaps, to do some things. So it is a jugunda effort. I want to say one thing, and this is not meant as a criticism. You will note on that page that the hospital provides treatment to several different populations. Follow. On the bottom, it says adolescents. With the stakeholders, the Oregon Youth Authority, at this stage of the game, they're out there, but they're not as involved in this master plan or in this document to the extent that, well, let's be careful here, Peter. They're out there, but they're not as specifically involved in this as, well, I don't know as they should be, but as perhaps we need to be aware of them, Mr. Nickel, and you know that because we've already discussed that.
Madam Chair, Senator Courtney, I'd just like to comment that I think they will be part of the stakeholders process, even in phase one.
Okay, so.
Great.
Madam Chair, I think that probably covers that part of the issue related to the Oregon State Hospital Master Plan. I had a couple of things here in terms of improving services that I just wanted to comment to the committee on. I think one of the significant improvements is related to the incorporation of more evidence-based practices into the work that we do. ACT, I wrote on the outline here, stands for Assertive Community Treatment. That's just meant as one example of the kind of thing that community programs need to be prepared to do, and to, in some cases, retrain staff to do something other than waiting for patients to come to them. Assertive community treatment is just what it sounds like. It means asserting yourself, getting out there as a staff person, seeing people in their home environments and helping them get whatever they need to do in order to live successful lives in the community, whether that's work or school or social relationships or whatever. We've talked quite a bit about the use of Medicaid in community services. I think that's nothing new, but I think that's a continued strategy that we can use to improve services and also to contain costs. I used another acronym there, PATES. It stands for Post-Acute Intermediate Treatment Services. I just wanted to comment that we have one program, a 16-bed facility, that takes people who would otherwise have to go to the state hospital. And rather than go there and spend as many as 6 months or sometimes longer, this is a program that's geared to turn people in and out of the program and connect them back with their community services in less than 90 days. And the average length of stay of this program, now it's been going now for over 2 years, is about 52 days. So they're taking people who would otherwise go to the state hospital. These people don't really need to be in a state hospital. They need an intensive residential level of care, and that's what they're getting. The daily cost of this program is about $200 a day, state general fund. But with Medicaid, it's really a $450 a day program, which is a very nice level of care. It's actually a little bit higher on a daily rate than the state hospital is, but because it's Medicaid, we can do it for half the cost of the state hospital. And if these people really needed to be in a state hospital, this wouldn't be such a good program. But these are people who really need an intensive level of care, but it can be done in a residential setting. We just have never had this level of care available before, and we tried this as a pilot, and you know, it is working just as we had hoped it would. So that's just another example. A prevention and early intervention program is EAST. That's actually the name of the program, and I think it stands for Early Assessment, Supports, and Treatment. It's a program that's in this Salem area. What they do is they take kids who are 16 to 24 years old having their first psychotic episode, and they wrap around services for the family and the adolescent, the young adult, and they get these kids back into school and back to work, and they keep them, for the most part, out of hospitals. And I think it's going, over time, to make a huge difference in the lives of these kids and their families. And incidentally, I think down the road, save the state a considerable amount of money. I know for a fact that there are kids in this program who probably would have been in the forensic unit if it weren't for this program, because they were at that stage of their life where they might have done something that could have gotten them into a very serious criminal justice involvement. We have headed that off, and I think these are the kind of programs that we've got to find a way to support in the future. Another way of improving services is to adapt what we call the recovery model, even in the state hospitals. And this is simply the idea that people with mental illnesses do not have to be consigned to a life of hopelessness. Most people with mental illnesses can recover. Now, recovery means something different for everybody, and recovery is not, I hope I don't offend anybody here, it's not some liberal, soft philosophy. It's, you know, anybody who's in recovery, whether it's from alcoholism or any other major disorder, knows that it's hard work. So the recovery concept is not a soft-hearted way of dealing with people, but it's a different way of thinking about what we should expect from people. We have, I think, traditionally underestimated the ability of people with even major mental illnesses to work. But we need to approach them differently, and we need to provide them with the kind of supports and the kind of philosophy to do that. And finally, I just wanted to mention the children's budget note. I think this does hold promise to have a much better integrated system of care for kids, particularly those kids who are going to need high level of service. And again, the idea is not to have them out of their family situations any more than we have to. And although there is definitely a place for residential psychiatric programs and psychiatric day treatment, we really need to try to find ways to make sure we're using those resources the most efficient way and to find ways to work with families where they really need that help the most. And that's often and back in the lives where they've really got to figure out how they're going to work with the schools and with managing their lives without a lot of additional structure. So I just wanted to call attention to, there are many other ideas that we have, but I wanted to call attention to at least these five areas, examples for us to think further about how to improve services and contain costs in the long run.
I want to thank you both, Gina Furman and Bob Nickel, for starting the dialogue. And hopefully it's not going to be just talk, that we're actually going to make some movement in helping our mentally ill be productive people in our society, which they can be, but our system really has to, we need some work to work on it. Anyway, we need to adjourn unless there's any comments, because the next committee is going to be in here at 3. If there's no further comments, the meeting is adjourned.